dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence it is our privilege to tap each week when it comes to matters involving American interests in and other developments involving the Far East is Gordon Chang. He is a contributor to Forbes.com, a blogger at World Affairs Journal, and a columnist for The Daily Beast. You see him frequently at Fox and in other outlets. He is the author of two absolutely best-selling and terrifically important books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, the New York Times prominently featured in its Sunday editions a story concerning Jared Kushner's sister, who was in Beijing advertising her family connections, I guess is what they're called, to a bunch of prospective Chinese investors, which all evidently had to do with not only getting money from them, but getting them U.S. green cards through something called the EB-5 visa program. What did you make of this, Gordon? And what in particular should the rest of us make of it?
This is unseemly. And of course, when you have a family that is deeply involved in business, these types of things are going to happen. But this is particularly loathsome. And so I think that the United States, we should all look at this and just condemn it. This is the type of thing that we always are concerned about, of foreign influence and indeed of Americans selling this influence. I can't think of any justification for this. Yes, it's legal, but clearly this is wrong.
Yeah, I wonder whether, in fact, it is legal. I think there are certain injunctions on the kind of capitalizing or influence peddling for those in office. And the Times, of course, paints it pretty darkly as Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, and, well, increasingly his right-hand man, it seems, isn't entirely divorced from the companies and projects that were being advertised in this case. But at the very least, I think you're right. It's improper, unseemly, and potentially a security problem, Gordon, because one of the things that I've been worrying about this visa program is essentially you buy access to the United States and a path to citizenship, for that matter. And as long as it's business, it seems not to really be subject to the kind of scrutiny that it should require. We did a paper recently about a similar kind of use of this program being done to enable the family of Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb maker to gain a controlling interest in the management of Port Canaveral in Florida, a very strategic port. So I really worry about that aspect of this, as well as the possibilities that these kinds of considerations may be having an impact on Jared Kushner's role as an advisor to the president with respect to China. Do you have thoughts on that piece of it in particular, Gordon?
Well, you know, with regard to Kushner, this story comes on the heels of Kushner's trying to deal with Anbang Insurance Company, which is a shadowy enterprise in China. Many people believe that Anbang is controlled by Chinese leaders through various proxies and intermediaries. Now, that deal was unusually favorable to the Kushner family. Fortunately, it was dropped after the glare of publicity. But this seems to be a problem with the Kushner family. You know, with regard to the visas themselves, every country or most countries have programs of this sort. And so, therefore, they do bring into the concerns that you talk about. But especially they come into the fore when you have a family closely connected with the President of the United States peddling visas in a country which intends to harm us. I mean, as you say, what could go wrong?
Gordon, let me switch gears. The Chinese, of course, have been a focus of the Trump presidency's efforts to bring to heel Beijing's proxies in North Korea. You've written, as I mentioned, a very important book on the subject, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. We visit about what the North is up to each week, I think. But at the moment, one of the quid pro quo that the Chinese apparently attempted to extract from President Trump as a gesture, perhaps, or as a necessary precondition to their doing anything to help him on Pyongyang, was the cashiering, they demanded, the cashiering of the commander of U.S. Pacific Command, Admiral Harry Harris. What is up with that, and why would they want him removed?
Well, the Chinese would want Harris removed because he's taken a more resolute position in the Pacific. And also, we can't be too fine about this. The Chinese don't like the fact that Harris has Japanese blood in him. And this is something that official media talks about in very racist terms. So clearly they want Harris out of the picture. Now, President Trump can't control what the Chinese proposed to him. But this story comes 2 or 3 days after the story that the Pentagon would not agree to Harris's request for freedom of operation, freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. And these operations are, of course, directed towards China's attempts to infringe on the global commons. So you put these two stories together and you become very concerned about what the administration is doing. I think that in this case, we need a clear explanation from the Pentagon and maybe even from the White House itself about the lack of FONOPs in the South China Sea, especially because of what the Chinese wanted in this particular case of getting Harris moved off to the side.
This is very troubling. I was unaware that they had declined his request, Gordon, at the Pentagon. I wonder whether that may have been a request that was actually denied in the White House, and again, whether Jared Kushner may have had a hand in that. But, Gordon, this was one of the things that, as I recall, President Trump as a candidate was quite critical of his predecessor over, was kowtowing to the Chinese and their assertion, notably through these fortified and man-made islands in the South China Sea. This would be quite a departure from his stated position on the campaign trail, would it not?
Well, in general, Trump took a very difficult position from the Chinese point of view on trade and all sorts of issues. And what we have seen is Trump's pivot to some very China-friendly policies. The whole idea, of course, was to try to get Beijing to help on North Korea. And because of that, Trump has actually said in public, in writing, in tweets, you know, why would I declare them a currency manipulator if they're helping on North Korea, quote unquote. So clearly Trump is trying to make a deal. These deals, I think, are wrong. I mean, one may argue that they are in the U.S. national interest. I don't think so. But nonetheless, there are some very big issues involved here. The United States is doing some things which I think are indeed troubling in terms of acceding to the Chinese. The big issue here, next one coming up, is going to be arms sales to Taiwan, which apparently we're going to go through until very recently, and now they seem to be stalled. So at this point, people just need to start asking questions of the Trump administration and their relationship with China. And it goes from Kushner to all sorts of issues. But nonetheless, this is not going in the right direction for the United States.
Well, and as you appreciate, I think probably better than just about anybody else, certainly in the public arena these days, Gordon Chang, what you're talking about entails, among other things, signals being sent to the Chinese, quite apart from, you know, the facts on the ground or in the water, as the case may be. We're looking at, I'm afraid, sort of inducements to worse behavior on the part of the Chinese, even if at the moment they may be currying the notion that they're going to help us with the North Koreans. I seriously doubt that. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. As always, your assessments of these very important developments in a critically important part of the world are indispensable to us, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us each week. We'll look forward to doing so with you again next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Peter Husey right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Peter Husey. He is the grand poobah and driving force behind an important organization in Washington, D.C. It's called Geostrategic Analysis. He is a man who has for many years conducted some of the most important public fora on national security policy in general, and specifically educating members of Congress and their staff and the rest of us about arcane matters involving nuclear deterrence, missile defense, and the like. He is a frequent contributor to us and a regular contributor to Family Security Matters, Opinion Daily, and Real Clear Defense, where he has been publishing an important triptych on Iran. And we're very anxious to pick his brains about that and more. Peter Husey, welcome back. Good to have you.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's very nice of you to have me on.
I want to get into sort of some of your thinking about what we should do about Iran, Peter, but if you would, just sort of level set with us on where we are. We had, of course, the spectacle recently of having the Trump administration say everything's hunky-dory with this so-called deal with Iran, only to have the Secretary of State trotted out the next day, apparently because President Trump was not happy about that first message, to repudiate it, I guess, in a way. What's going on, Peter? Is Iran, in fact, abiding by the terms of this nuclear deal and therefore a member in good standing of the international community, or is that not the case?
Well, I think you have to start with what's the deal. We have a lot of side deals, which we keep discovering, which we weren't told about at the beginning, as you know. And those terms are unknown. Second, the very narrow thing of those declared sites that produce nuclear fuel that Iran has, they can't enrich beyond a certain level, and they can't produce more than a certain level, but they have to ship it out of the country. If you believe the Iranians have told us everything that's there, then on that narrow, narrow scope of those declared sites, which are some self-inspected, okay, they shipped some of the fuel out. They shipped it to Cyprus once. They actually exceeded it a number of times. But to me, that's irrelevant.
Peter Husey is our guest. We are talking about the so-called deal with Iran. And Peter, you've pretty handsomely described how inadequate the deal is, and are, I think, making the point that even if they comply with it, it's not satisfactory. Finish that thought, if you would.
Okay, well, let's start from the beginning in 1979. The Iranian Revolution put into place an Islamic revolutionary government dedicated to the spread of Islam through terrorism, military force, sabotage, and all the rest of it. It's like a James Bond, a Smersh and Spectre guys. And the new National Security Advisor of the President, McMaster, wrote an article recently where he called it the Hezbollah strategy, where you come into a country like Lebanon and you destroy it by putting the terrorists in charge, which is what they're doing in Yemen, what they're trying to do. We've already done it in Syria because that's the guy in charge, Assad. So you have a regime that, if you look at the attacks that the United States has endured in Lebanon, our Marines and our embassy, you look at Khobar Towers, you look at the embassies in Africa. So as your wonderful lady, Vice President, I believe, of the Senate, Claire Lopez, has pointed out, Iran is up to their eyeballs in attacks on America. But one more thing. According to the military, IEDs planted by Iran in Afghanistan and Iraq have killed over 500 American soldiers and wounded as many more. That's number one. Number two, given this is the regime and this is what they're after in terms of attacking us, Why should we think that somehow this agreement all of a sudden ended their human rights abuses, their missile production levels, their conventional military advances, and their goals of basically controlling not only the Persian Gulf area and all the oil and gas that represents, but a good deal of the Muslim world? So in that context, what's this deal do? It doesn't do anything about the missiles, nothing about human rights, nothing about conventional weapons, nothing about terrorism. And now they're giving missiles to the Houthi rebels in Yemen that are launching them at Saudi oil facilities in Saudi Arabia. And if you think the Persian Gulf is not an issue, well, it's about half of all the oil traded in international commerce on board the oceans in any one day. And if that was cut off or cut down, oil would go to probably, my guess is, $200 a barrel. And we would be, you think a recession in 2008 and 2009 was bad. Wait until that happens.
And Peter, you might throw into that mix the fact that they are angling to put themselves in a similar position through their proxies in Yemen to control the Red Sea as well. And the combined effect of that would be even worse.
That's the western part of Saudi Arabia that produces exports about 5 million barrels. Add that to the 7.5, 8 million that goes on the East Coast. And you're talking about 15 million barrels out of a total of about 75 million a day. You're talking about a huge leverage. And this administration, from what I can tell from General Mattis and General McMaster and the president and others, they're finally taking it seriously that the Iranians are not just terrorists, but they have geostrategic aims allied with China and Russia and Syria. And what really worries me is North Korea, because they have a technology defense agreement with them where they trade missile and nuclear technology. And every time they blow up a nuclear weapon in North Korea or test a missile, you know who's hanging around. We have pictures of the mullahs, leaders of the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and the leadership of Iran happen to be there. And I know they're there not to set up tourist camps or something. So it's a very deadly combination that we're facing. And I think the administration, you know, God bless them, is finally facing it up.
Peter, I want to come back to you on some other aspects of this Iran deal, but I do want to take advantage of your expertise in Korea as well, and your knowledge of these nuclear relationships and strategic partners that the North Koreans are with the Iranians, to ask you about this idea. We just discussed it a little bit with Gordon Chang, but is it sensible? Is it desirable? Let alone is it likely to conduce to good things for the president of the United States to be talking about a face-to-face meeting with Kim Jong-un under these circumstances? Where, as you say, it certainly seems as though these two dangerous regimes are making each other more dangerous.
I would say that if part of the deal was a verifiable elimination of its nuclear weapons, I would go meet with the creep, okay? I understand what the president is saying. I think the key here is, as Gordon Chang probably told you, China either has to fish or cut bait. They are, I had a breakfast last Friday, in which Joe Bosco, formerly of CSIS and the Office of Secretary of Defense, and Bruce Klinger, a really fabulous analyst at Heritage Foundation, who used to be the head of the Korea desk in the CIA and DIA for over 20 years, they both said North Korea currently, according to four United States military officers, each with four stars on their shoulders, can range all of the United States with ballistic missiles, have been able to miniaturize nuclear weapons. And the only question is, have they been able to mate the warhead with the missile yet? And we don't know, but you kind of have to assume they have when you're looking at a rocket being launched from Central Korea, North Korea. So they have a very serious capability. Now, my God, what if they share it with Iran? And my view is China is complicit in the development of both the missiles and North Korean nukes, helped them do it through the Khan network in Pakistan with respect to nukes. We have found that South Koreans gave us missile parts they found in the ocean from North Korea. They had both Chinese and Russian markings on them. And the South Koreans figured that they had 10,000 kilometer range, which is enough to get to most of the United States.
If we do indeed face a deadly problem, and it's becoming more deadly by the day, I'm afraid. Peter Husey, your insights into these matters and the help that you're giving all of us to understand them is really appreciated, both here at Secure Freedom Radio and in your various programs. Keep up the great work you do at Family Security Matters and elsewhere, and course, of Geostrategic Analysis. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, Michael Cutler joins us. We'll talk with him about immigration-related issues and what they mean for your security and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by J. Michael Waller, a man who I have known and worked with and admired greatly over a long period of time. I'm very pleased to say he is these days Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, managing our government relations portfolio. Among other skill sets Mike has is a deep knowledge of the practice and the intellectual underpinnings of political warfare. He has taught at the graduate level in this space and is a great resource, which we're very pleased to bring to the Secure Freedom Radio audience. Mike, great to have you. Welcome.
Great to be back, Frank.
Well, there's a couple of news pegs in the political warfare space du jour. We're talking before Sally Yates, the former acting Attorney General of the United States, testifies before the Congress as this program airs. We'll know what she said. I think it's fair to assume she will be mostly trashing former National Security Advisor to the President Mike Flynn and explaining the kind of surveillance operations that were run against him and the campaign of Donald Trump, in order to ferret out evidence that the Russians were somehow involved in trying to steal or hack the election or otherwise influence its outcome. Mike, give us a sense of whether there's anything surprising in the fact that the Russians would be interested in doing that sort of thing, whether you agree that they were probably trying to throw the election towards Donald Trump, and thirdly, what, if any, evidence you think is there to support such contentions?
Well, we shouldn't be surprised that the Russians are meddling in our political system, Frank, because they've been doing it since the 1920s. And it's only been this past year in modern history that the Democrats have ever had an objection to it. If you'll recall, Ronald Reagan was under vicious Soviet active measures attack, and a lot of the Democrats in Congress not only denied that the active measures were taking place, but they some of them actually took part in those active measures propaganda campaigns.
And as you've pointed out, Mike, the Democrats, more to the point, have had a long history of enabling Soviet influence operations, including Soviet and Russian influence operations, including in the 1984 election, as I recall. Talk a little bit about Teddy Kennedy's role, for example, in that regard.
This is one where we have absolute proof from the Kremlin that Ted Kennedy, he was the senator from Massachusetts who was the lead Democrat politician back in the early 1980s against Reagan, had actually offered his services to the Soviets in the 1970s in exchange for a deal for free oil from the new Soviet colony in Angola. This would became the genesis of the Kennedy family's charitable home heating oil foundation for poor families in New England. And the Soviets
and collaboration with enemies of the United States in furthering their agenda there.
Right. And we have this in the exact documents that the KGB gave to the Soviet Politburo starting in the 1970s. These were the summaries of KGB Chairman Andropov's meetings with a representative of Ted Kennedy, and then his report, Andropov's report, to the Soviet Communist Party leadership. And later on, a lengthy three-page report, which I have in Russian, from the KGB detailing this much further. So there's absolutely no question that here you have the senior statesman for the modern-day liberal Democrats actively collaborating in a spy-like way. This is not just some crooked business deal, but this was actual espionage as an agent of influence.
But also specifically, as I recall, asking for their help in his election prospects, right? That he would be willing to play ball with them if that were forthcoming. This is only one example, and Mike Waller, you've been documenting a series of very, very problematic, shall we say, Democratic machinations with the Kremlin over the years. One of my particular concerns is the effort that was made by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama during the first Obama term to set up a Silicon Valley in Russia. Remind us what happened with that and the extent to which that feathered some nests in a way that suggests certainly intervention in our domestic political affairs and a lot of corruption to boot.
Oh, well, this was something, it was a project that was prompted by the Clinton Foundation staff and then authorized by Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, in 2010, where the State Department put together the visit of 28 senior American high-tech CEOs and venture capitalists, most of whom were donors to the Clinton Foundation. They went to a place outside Moscow called Skolkovo, which was, they like to call Russia's Silicon Valley. A U.S. Army report calls Skolkovo an overt alternative to clandestine industrial espionage. So really, this was a big military technology transfer operation that the Clinton Foundation had the State Department put together on Hillary's behalf and on behalf of her friends to transfer American military technology to the Russians in exchange for cash.
Yeah, cash that went into the foundation, cash that apparently also went into, in one case, President Bill Clinton's pocket, something on the order of $500,000, as I recall, for a speech. Mike Waller, is there any indication that these issues, and these are just a sample of a dozen or more that I'm aware of, are going to be the subject of investigation by the Congress, for which there's actually a lot more evidence than that Mike Flynn or anybody else, for that matter, colluded with the Russians to steal the election of 2016 in this country?
Oh, we don't know, because the Republicans have never held an aggressive oversight hearing of anything that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama have done in terms of abusing their office for corrupt purposes. So, in fact, John McCain and the Senate Republicans want to have bipartisan hearings with Chuck Schumer to go after Donald Trump in the 2016 elections. And that's fair if it was only, you know, if that was the only problem. But none of these Republicans really have come forward to say, hey, we have to investigate all the stuff that Hillary Clinton and Obama did that corrupted their offices and undermined our country. So I'm not too confident of that. However, President Trump just sent out a tweet yesterday saying that he wonders why there's no investigation of the Democrats and their collusion with Russia. So if the president is onto this now, I think this is going to get some legs.
Well, let's hope so. And I know we'll be working to support that very important oversight responsibility on the part of the Congress in this space if they're going to do due diligence. I mean, this is not a partisan thing. This is just to make sure that we really do understand the magnitude, the extent, and the implications of the various influence operations the Russians have been running against us and the help that they've gotten from Americans. It isn't, as I say, confined to the Republicans, that's for sure. Mike, I want to take note of something that is perhaps promising, that a fund has apparently been established, $100 million by the Congress to counter Russian propaganda efforts. You know a lot about the propaganda business, particularly as it's conducted by the Kremlin. What are we to make of this new initiative, and do you think it'll make a difference?
Oh, this initiative was sponsored by Senator Portman of Ohio, who's been very concerned with Russia issues for quite a while, and it's to establish a $100 million fund to counter Russian propaganda. This is to do it through different sort of semi-official organizations that the United States established under Ronald Reagan, and to fund groups and movements and investigative journalism and so forth to break through the censorship system of Vladimir Putin and his political machine in Russia. I'm hopeful, at least, because there's a bipartisan support for such an initiative to counter Russian propaganda. But of course, we have maybe two people in the entire federal government with the experience and the innovation to make something like this effective. And one of them is at retirement age. So I don't really hold out a whole lot of hope that it's going to amount to much.
we better grow some more. And I know you've been doing yeoman work in that regard, Mike, with your teaching over the years. And I know at the Center for Security Policy, your efforts are going to be redoubled. So I appreciate your work there as well as your periodic visits with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. We'll look forward to further visits in the near future with you on these issues and much, much more. Next up, Michael Cutler joins us. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Michael Cutler. He is one of our duty experts on matters involving immigration, border security, and national security. He served for some 30 years in the Immigration and Naturalization Services of the United States. He was also, in that capacity, assigned to a variety of task forces that ran the gamut from drug enforcement to countering terrorism. He is an extraordinarily knowledgeable and prolific contributor to the public policy debate, notably through his writings at Front Page Magazine and Family Security Matters, among others. He is also a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization, and always a welcome guest here. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Frank, for having me.
Michael, let me quickly get to the matter at hand, which is you are describing in your writings some very important developments, and I'd like to get at the heart of one of them, which is the undermining, really, of our national policies with respect to immigration that came about, at least in part, because of essentially the takeover of the trade union movement in the United States by the radical left, the Democratic Socialists. Give us the backstory there and how it's playing out today to the great detriment of American workers.
Sure. You know, I was watching the May Day demonstrations. My dad was a construction worker. I've always been a blue-collar supporter. And I came to call it the mayhem demonstrators when you look at the rioting and the damage that was done. And they're demanding two diametrically opposed things simultaneously. On the one hand, they are insisting on better wages and working conditions for workers. But yet, on the other hand, they're talking about not enforcing the immigration laws. The immigration laws were originally run by the Labor Department. The whole notion was to never make Americans compete with foreign workers. And by doing that, you were able to build the middle class. Now, in fact, Greenspan testified for Schumer back in 2009 about this. He said if we could stop shielding American workers from foreign competition, we could drive down the wage premium of what he called the privileged elite middle-class high-tech workers. So this all flies in the face of what's in the best interests of workers, but the unions are looking to get as many members as possible, which gives them leverage, and as much dues as possible, which gives them money. The two elixirs of power, isn't it? Leverage and money.
Well, and the Democratic Party, which is pretty much in the pocket of the trade union movement, unfortunately, has made this deal as well, looking for voters, it appears, again, at the expense of American workers who have for many years, of course, been the backbone of the Democratic Party. You mentioned Chuck Schumer. He was one of those who flipped on all of this, as I recall, from being very much opposed to illegal immigration to being one of the great apologists for it, if not enablers of it. Is that right?
And you know what's so interesting is if you look at my article on the Front Page, I mentioned the SEIU, the Service Employees Union. Their position parallels the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is the most anti-American and anti-labor special interest group in recent memory.
And usually at odds with the trade unionists, right?
Right. So they both sides are ganging up on the average worker, and they're getting shafted royally.
Yeah. And with it, again, our security as well, because what these folks are bringing in, as you've helped me understand so much, Michael Cutler, is a whole lot of criminal activity. Of course, not all of them, apart from the criminal activity of coming into the country illegally. But a great many are participating in, or at least, again, enabling of, the drug trafficking and human trafficking and various other gang and criminal activity, which raises the question, and terrorism, not least, exactly right, which raises the question again, as you're looking at this sort of new administration which came to office promising to remedy some of this, how's it doing, Michael Cutler?
Well, I think they're doing okay. I think they're getting a lot of pushback from both political parties. You know, as I keep pointing out, this is about globalism versus populism. Both political parties have become globalists trying to satisfy their wealthy campaign contributors. You know, with the passage of the Citizens United, these special interest groups can pump unlimited amounts of money into campaigns. So both sides are now landing on the side of globalism. The Trump administration is a populist administration looking out for the average American. So the biggest hurdles are being created by both parties. They want to build the wall. Both parties oppose the wall. They want more agents to enforce the law. Both parties seem to be opposed. But, of course, the Democrats leading the charge. They're the most vociferous, the most forceful. And that's really where they're coming down on, is on open borders and what I call immigration anarchy, which is very dangerous. And, by the way, look at MS-13. What a violent gang. And yet you have communities around the United States, including Suffolk County and New York City, where there's very little cooperation between immigration and local law enforcement, when in fact they should be working hand in glove, as I did way back when I was an agent and spent a lot of time going after those drug trafficking organizations.
Yeah, well, presumably this is in part a function of the sanctuary cities and the mindset that it epitomizes. And Michael, you know, I do want to just give a plug to Trevor Loudon, whose film The Enemies Within you featured prominently in, as I have a bit part myself, I think, as do others of our colleagues. But he makes very clearly this point of the takeover of the Democratic Party. But you are certainly right that the Republicans, the establishment Republicans, at least, if not, you know, the Trump Republicans or the populist Republicans across the country, are nationalist Republicans are all in bed on this kind of open borders and supporting our various immigration laws. And your efforts to try to stand against that at California's for Population Stabilization is really appreciated, Michael. Let me ask you about one other story. In the Washington Free Beacon today, there's a report about an inspector general audit out of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. It suggests that there's a whole lot of databases that are being maintained to monitor visa overstays, but not many apprehensions as a result of them, like 0.4% of those that are identified as overstaying their visas. How serious a problem is visa overstay in the first instance, Michael? And more to the point, what does this kind of, it seems malfeasance mean for it?
Well, if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, I've arrested terrorists. I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. They made it clear that first and foremost, 9/11 was the result that other terrorist attacks were directly attributable to multiple failures of the immigration system, and that most of the terrorists that have been identified thus far entered the United States through ports of entries with visas and then went on to violate the terms of their admission. That's not to say that we don't likely have terrorists and criminals coming across other ways, stowing away on ships, the northern and southern borders and so forth. But if you look at the majority of the terrorists who've been caught, they entered through ports of entry. And this issue about visa security goes back to 1996, the Immigration Reform Act, to which I contributed, by the way, some insight. And that was a made it clear that we needed to finally have an accounting for whether or not aliens who were admitted ultimately left. And Accenture got a major contract for billions of dollars back in the early 90s, were never able to solve the problem. Accenture went away. The agency changed the name from U.S. Visit to the Office of Biometrics, something or other. Always the name changes. But the mission has never been accomplished. And in part, I have to attribute some of these failures to the creation of DHS. I call the Department of Homeland Surrender. President George W. Bush, when he created it, made immigration law enforcement so unwieldy. And so now you have multiple agencies and what used to be one agency having different databases, we have problems in sharing that data. And then, of course, traditionally, there's been an abject lack of interior enforcement agents to look for those people who overstay and violate their visas.
Michael Cutler, your admonitions on this and your counsel in how to remedy it is really extraordinarily appreciated. And thank you for sharing it with us just about each week. We're always delighted to have you with us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.